let's start the story. You're listening to Beyond the Archives with the creative research team on Origin, Ways of Being. Stories. Through them, we escape, we learn, and we are inspired. We take a journey. In September 2024, the creative research team started at Lab for Living at Sheffield Hallam University to develop stories for the Ways of Being platform to optimise cultural experiences for mental health in underrepresented young people online. This meant going into archives and supporting others to do so to search for people and artefacts that told a story. We hope they moved you like they moved us, but if they didn't, we hope that these stories inspire you to investigate the archives for yourselves and find stories that are meaningful to you. In this podcast, we explore the impact that these stories had on us and others, how they inspired us, and how they ultimately were placed on the Ways of Being website. Take a pew and have a listen. We'd also love to hear your thoughts.
And when I was picturing her living in New York and having to... And also, I don't know how much of this is true. I don't actually know what... There isn't a lot of evidence about what her life was like in New York. But in my mind, I was picturing her, you know, waking up in her apartment, taking the subway, doing the show, going back to her apartment, and she's alone. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've been there.
It's Kerry. Hi, Kerry.
Hi, Sophie.
Welcome to Beyond the Archives podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and also why you joined the Lab for Living team?
Thank you for having me on the podcast. So my name's Kerry. I am a history and politics graduate from the University of Sheffield, relatively fresh out of education. And I joined the project because I remember reading the job spec and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so up my alley. I think the element that really drew me to it was hidden stories, and a lot of the history that I've sort of studied or written about throughout my sort of educational career so far has been about marginalised people, marginalised stories, often from lots of different places, but I really love taking the historical perspective and I really enjoy connecting individual stories to wider structures and wider societal issues. And I think that's why I really love the hidden element of it. So investigating why people had been hidden, what had suppressed their story, what had made them marginalised. And yeah, that's me.
Well, I kind of remember you sort of knew the direction-ish that you wanted to travel when you kind of first started the stories, am I right? You sort of...
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you already know about the archive that you particularly used, or was that kind of... did that come out through your search?
Do you mean the Circus and History Archives?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I already knew about that because of studying history. One of my final year projects took me to that actual archive, the Fairground and Circus Archive. I did it for one of my final year projects. It was a public history project. So I started with that one because I was like, right, I know how to use this archive. I've accessed it before. I'm not really scared of it. Mm-hmm. And so that for me, that was a good place to start.
And why particularly Lulu Adams? Shen's the story here.
Yeah.
What did you already know about her beforehand is what I'm thinking about. Or was she kind of found to you in kind of the process of discovering the archive, and what was it about her that made you think, yes, I want to hone in on this person, I want to know more?
I didn't know about her before. I knew, based on my own sort of own personal interest, I was really interested in women in performance and women in circuses or in sort of acting or stage. So I knew when I was going into the Fairground and Circus History Archives that was sort of in the back of my mind, that was something I was interested in. When I first started using it, I just sort of did the classic, just scroll. I was just scrolling for ages. And then I refined my search a little bit more. They have some like search categories on the side of the archive. Like I clicked like Wall of Death, which turns out is like a type of fairground ride. There wasn't anything there. And then I clicked on Clown and I was scrolling through all these images of clowns that are found in the archives. And then this picture of this woman appeared. And she had this like sort of painted face, these massive painted eyelashes, a big sort of conical hat. And I think the thing that really drew me to her was her outfit, which was just covered in like sparkles and satin. And she was sort of sat on this table holding a rabbit, like a rabbit toy. Oh. Yeah. And I was like, okay, this is weird. And so I sort of, obviously I clicked on the picture because it got my interest. And then I saw that the archive actually had a whole collection dedicated to her, and it said the Lulu Adams collection, and that was the first place that I sort of saw her. And then I got to click on that sort of collection, and it took me to a web page that had all of these images about her, her family, her career, her husband, and I just sort of realized that there was this, like, whoever this lady was, there was a wealth of images about, well, sorry, wealth of archive material about her. So then the next step was secondary research.
You mentioned that you're really interested in women in performance. And so I can imagine that kind of when you sort of found out about Lulu Adams, that was quite an immediate,
yes, yeah.
I need to find out about this person.
Yeah.
But what specifically about women in performance kind of draws you in? Why is that an area that you're really interested in?
Yeah, I think probably, I feel like the sort of academic answer is that I read, I can't even remember their name now, but the academic who basically wrote that all of gender is a performance, essentially.
What, Judith Butler?
Yes. Sorry, Judith. I should remember your name.
That's right, we'll edit in it.
Yeah, we'll edit that. The academic answer is that I read Judith Butler when I was in university, and that obviously sort of flipped a switch in me where I was like, oh my gosh, gender is a performance. Everything is a performance. We're all performing all the time. And I think that sort of linked in my mind this thing of performance, acting, putting on a show, and how we express ourselves in gender. And so I think that was always in the back of my mind, but I also, a few years ago, I got into drama. I started working for a theatre, but I'd never really been interested in the theatre. I fell into it on accident, and then they put on a show, and I helped perform in that show, because I was like, oh, whatever, I'll just do a little bit. And then I ended up on the stage, and it wasn't a very big stage. I think we only did it to like 60 people, and it was free. But I really, really enjoyed it, and it made me think a lot about what it means to be a woman on the stage. And then when I was in my final year of university, I did a project about Vesta Tilly, who is a relatively well-known drag king from the 1930s, and she would essentially dress as a man on stage and perform to these Victorian audiences. And I always thought that sort of stuff like drag didn't really exist until the 60s and 70s, and thanks to, you know, RuPaul, I also didn't really think that drag kings existed, women who dressed as men. And so I got really, really interested in her, and it just made me realise all of the really intricate and fascinating details about gender and being on stage and how they're linked. I just think there's it's so interesting, and there's such a wealth of both knowledge and also sort of conversations we can have to do with gender and performance.
I think it is a really interesting one, and there's something there around kind of both performing gender but also playing with it and being playful with that kind of notion. I think especially of kind of like the drag kings that I've seen that I've found really, really interesting and just great to watch as well.
Yeah.
But also specifically the notion of kind of clowning as, I guess it is quite playful, but there's so much more there as well. And I think we were speaking earlier about kind of the idea that she's often called a female clown rather than just a clown.
Yeah.
And my thought process around that is maybe getting a little bit annoyed that gender needs to be mentioned, but actually is gender like a really intrinsic part of the performance, and is it a really intrinsic part of what she's doing? So maybe it is important to say a female clown. You know, so,
I see what you mean. I think both yes and no. Like, I think on the one hand, she was sort of clowning like everybody else. And I think when you look at a lot of the quotes from Lulu Adams, even though she's very aware of her own femininity, I mean, she dresses very female, outwardly female. She just wants to clown like everybody else. She's not out here necessarily trying to make she speaks a lot about being sort of good representation as a female clown. But it's quite clear that she loves clowning purely for the joy of it, and she just wants to do it along with everybody else. But I think it's also on the other hand, it's good to talk about her because her gender really impacted the way she worked and who she was and how she sort of viewed in the context of clowning generally.
I guess there's something also to say there about how we kind of put what we're looking for on figures from the past. So,
yes, 100%.
Like I'd say I'm, you know, when I came across Lulu Adams, obviously through your work, I'm putting on her that she kind of needs to be a good representative for women in general, for playing with playing with gender.
Yeah.
I think, but that's not, doesn't necessarily have to be right in it. If anything, it's more interested to have kind of more of a complicated understanding of a whole individual. You know, she doesn't have to be someone who very clearly fought for women. You know, she doesn't have to particularly be saying something. I think a lot of the time she is, but also she is a complicated character. Yeah. And I think you've mentioned previously that you know, we can kind of problematize some things that maybe she said or done as well.
Yeah.
And that's fine, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I think you've hit on a very good point, because to be fair, one thing I found in my relatively limited sort of delving into women and performance is that so often they are so much more complicated and problematic than we think. Like Vesta Tilly, when I got really deep into her, when I watched her, I was like, when I first found her, I was like, oh my gosh, she's this drag king, she's a woman, she's pushing gender boundaries. It turns out she was really conservative. She was really big into wartime recruitment, which actually sounds like it's a sort of ahistorical thing to say, but there actually was criticism of her at the time because it was World War I recruitment. And there was a lot of criticism of her being like, you're recruiting for this sort of pointless war.
Mm.
And that really made me cotton on to the fact that just because somebody is a woman in history and they're the sort of first of their kind and they're pushing the boundary does not make them inherently good. And Lulu Adams, even though she's certainly less problematic than Vesta Tilly, when I was doing some of the archival research, I found a couple of interviews that she'd done in newspapers. And some of them she was sort of speaking about how, like, the only barrier to women being clowns is that we all take ourselves too seriously. And it was really kind of giving, like, oh, I'm so different, I'm not like other girls.
Right.
And it was very much she... And even though she does speak in some interviews about how, you know, this progression in women's jobs, and she definitely links her place in clowning to sort of bigger political movements, it's quite clear she can also be a little bit redundant of why more women aren't in clowning. And I found that really frustrating. And then I was like, no, she is a normal, complicated person. And and that's okay. She doesn't have to be this perfect representation of a female clown.
Yeah, I think we can kind of take what we need from her. But also I think that's a very interesting comment for her to make, and maybe definitely flattens the experience of other women at the time, especially since she born into kind of a circus family.
Yeah, she is essentially a clown nepo baby. And I'm like, well, you know, Lulu, you can all say that women take themselves too seriously, but you literally had the clown door open for you. And the reason why women, I imagine a lot of Victorian women didn't want to act silly or took themselves too seriously is because of the gender constraints that were put on them.
Yeah, because there were serious repercussions for a lot of women.
Exactly.
If that happened.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very. I'm just got a clown door open for her. Dear me.
The clown car door was opened.
The tiny, tiny car.
The teeny little car.
Had a small door that opened to three more doors. But behind all of them was clowns. I think watching your video, I think one thing that came across was the humour that you used whilst telling the story. At least I hope it was intended. I found it very funny.
It was actually a very serious video. Oh, no. It was actually deadly serious.
So what kind of importance do you put on humour when sort of telling stories and kind of narrating people's lives?
For me, I think more than probably I like to admit, I think humour is like a crucial part of telling stories for me. I think I often find really serious stories, and obviously there are some stories where there are no humour in them, but the ones that I connect with are the ones where there's a bit of humour. And I think it represents the full scale of people's experiences. Our lives are tragic and they're hilarious, and they can be tragic and hilarious. And I think stories that are told with just those elements, especially if it's a story in a platform like Origin, where if you're telling somebody's life story and you're just going, and this happened, and then this happened, and it was awful, and it was terrible, is somebody going to be able to connect to that as a real complicated person?
Mm.
Not necessarily. I think I love humour and storytelling. I love comedians and comedy, and I think it, for me, it's a really great vehicle to tell a story.
Yeah, I think it makes it a lot more both kind of approachable and accessible.
Yeah.
humour in storytelling really allows for a real gradient of emotion to be present. And I think that when it is just kind of fact after fact, you do miss the human connection that's there with you. You miss the kind of the actual intrinsic human element that comes along, which is that there are awful times. And then a lot of the stories that we're telling on this platform, there is a lot of suffering that happens within them. But maybe to boil down someone's life just to the suffering that they had is in itself quite problematic, I think.
Yeah.
It's important to insert that levity.
Yeah.
And sometimes making light of life a little bit, you know, that there is laughter, there is humour, and it's okay.
The thing also with me telling stories with humour, I think I can be all sort of like fancy and academic about it, but I actually think the main thing is that that's the only way I know how to tell stories.
But I think as well, a lot of people when telling their own story will insert a lot of humour into it. And I think sometimes that is both about being vulnerable, self-conscious sometimes.
Yeah.
But also that it's okay, and it's sometimes it's a bit of a way to manage or a bit of a way to cope, or we can very easily look back in hindsight and say that something was funny. It probably definitely didn't feel funny at the time.
Yeah, 100%.
I think with Lulu Adams there's a lot there that isn't funny.
Yeah.
that is certainly real suffering. But I think in your story you really managed to kind of get the depth of emotion there, there is both, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I think that, and in particular I'm sort of thinking about your bit where you talk a little bit about kind of your own emotions. And I wonder kind of what that experience was like for you to sort of do that. And what kind of emotions were present actually when thinking about kind of Lulu Adams and her story.
To be fair, because this was sort of the first story that we'd done, I feel like I wasn't really sure about sort of like what level of myself that I wanted to insert into it. But then as I was, I hadn't necessarily planned it, but as I was sort of doing the process of creating the video, I realised it was so personal. It was like me sitting in my bedroom with my camera in my bedroom and I'm doing clown makeup. I was like, this is a really sort of personal thing. And I think it would have felt a bit inauthentic if I only shared the sort of funny personal side, like, oh haha, this clown makeup is looking bad, right, let's continue the story, without sharing the sort of slightly sadder personal side. And to be fair, there's a lot about Lulu's life, especially the sort of sadder stuff, that I don't relate to, like I've never lost a husband. But the bit that made me think about my own experience was when I was reading a blog post by, she's a fellow female clown, but she's a sort of current day one, and she was reflecting on Lulu Adams's impact. And she just had this quote that was like, it's really sort of sad to imagine Lulu as a clown all alone in a big city by herself. And I was like, oh my God, yeah. Because I've been alone in a big city. Like when I did my year abroad, I was really lonely for the first 3 months. And like everything I said in the video about like eating alone and crying on public transport, like it's all true. And when I was picturing her living in New York and having to, and also I don't know how much of this is true, I don't actually know what, there isn't a lot of evidence about what her life was like in New York, but in my mind I was picturing her, you know, waking up in her apartment, taking the subway, doing the show, going back to her apartment, and she's alone. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've been there. And I guess it makes you realise that stories in history, doesn't matter how far back they go, they're all universal in the end.
Absolutely. And I think that really resonated with me as well. And I think it felt really important to mention. And no, we probably can't really, and even if Lulu were to write in her diary, this is exactly how I'm feeling, we probably wouldn't have been able to kind of completely understand exactly what that meant or exactly what was going on for her, because we're not her, and it's many, many years later. But I think the ability to kind of connect with that is very human. And also to think it's empathetic as well, isn't it, to think, I think I can understand what you're going through, and that's resonated with me. And I think to share that was really important as well, so thank you for doing
thank
that
you.
And it just felt really, really important as well to kind of give to give that little bit of speculation about kind of what that might have been for someone. I think we do have to bring stories to life, and yeah, there's probably a line there somewhere. I mean, there definitely is, but it's important. It's important that a story isn't just facts, that there is a bit of life there as well.
Yeah. I guess sort of empathy, especially with a historical person, is sort of like it's just an act of imagination, isn't it?
Mm.
You're always going to have to put some sort of imaginary story to be able to connect yourself with this person in time. And how accurate it is sometimes isn't important, because we have to be, I think you have to be empathetic, you have to be imaginative.
Mm.
And to be imaginative, you have to be empathetic. And I feel like those two go hand in hand. And the feedback that I got based off that story was really nice. And it made me think about all the other stories that I'm doing now. I think I'm taking that element now when I'm looking at all the other people in the archives and thinking about, yes, our lives are very different, but how do I connect to you? And even if I can't connect to you, do I know somebody who connects to you?
I think that leads very well to my last question. Ooh. Which is, if you were to take anything from Lulu's life or from what you learned of Lulu's life into your own life, what would that be?
That's hard. Because I mean, I feel like from this, they've had a serious conversation, but I do want to say, Lulu had a pretty glamorous, cool life from what I could tell. So there was a lot from her life that I would take. Mostly the costumes. Oh my gosh, her costumes were so great. It was my favourite part about researching her, like seeing all the beautiful things that she wore. Like, she wore sequins and she wore these like big sort of, she had these crazy like big tulle collars, and she, her famous, most famous look was like a sort of satin suit with these, you know, the sort of classic baggy clown pants and like sort of sparkly pom-poms. And she just looked amazing. And she also would wear sort of like star-spangled dresses or like pantsuits and things, and I want that in my life.
Well, where would you wear these things if you could? Anywhere.
Anywhere.
To Tesco.
To Tesco, to the office. I'm trying to get better, because one thing I think also that kind of made me relate to Lulu Adams is like, I have a lot of stupid clothes in my wardrobe. Like, I have like a big furry purple jacket and stuff, and watching her, and this is so weird, but I don't know, watching her and her like clown outfits, I was like, I should wear my clown clothes more. Mm. So I'm trying to wear my clown clothes more. And if she could historically donate her costumes to me now, I think that would help me in my mission of wearing my clown clothes everywhere.
Well, I mean, I did send a message to you about this, but Wikipedia doesn't actually officially know that she's died.
Yes.
So she is now 124 years old.
Amazing.
So
I will
look her up.
I'll look her up. I assume she's still in Brighton. I'll be like, Lulu, give me some. I'm definitely going to, when sort of do the re-record of the video, I'm 100% going to include that fact in it.
Fantastic.
About her still being alive.
So Wikipedia's like, she's a 124? My goodness.
To be fair, when I was looking, I think the reason why they don't have her death date on there is because when I was trying to do some research, there's 2 years when she could have died, and they're not entirely sure. So I think Wikipedia was like, best not to include either. She'll just live forever.
But that's like, you can't say a lot of, when a lot of people died, like people from the Tudor period, I mean, there's a lot of like birthdays and death. Are they like 400 or 500 years old?
Yeah.
I would love that.
Actually, I wouldn't love that. I don't want a person from Tudor times walking around now.
Why?
Because they've got a lot of weird opinions on how you should eat meat.
Specifically those opinions.
I remember learning about Tudors and I was like, cool, this is fine. But then learning the things they ate at feasts, that when I was like, I can no longer relate to you on a level. Like, why are you stuffing birds? Why are you eating lamb? Was it, is it lampard? The type of eel?
I think I know what you mean. I don't know if it is the eel, but yeah.
The eel pie. I was like, this is disgusting. And that was where I sort of cut myself off.
And that's why we don't have any stories
from the about Tudor time. Tudors. Tudors actually entirely excluded from.
I don't think we do actually.
Maybe we should do some Tudors.
Well, no, we've already said the reason.
Yeah, sorry, no, we banned Tudors because of their eating habits.
Well, I think the takeaway therefore is to not do any stories on the Tudors.
Yeah, perfect.
But also just bring a bit more clown into our lives.
100%. I think that's a great conclusion. Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you, Kerry.